This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by the Dudley Boys of What Culture, Michael Hanflot and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts where we not only review AEW Dynamite, but also AEW Rampage, Raw, SmackDown, NXT 2.0, pay-per-views, bloody premium live events. We have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week completes with a bloody good quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. As I said, though, joined by Hanflot and Sidgwick to review AEW Dynamite, and they listened.
They listened. They goddamn listened. Just in case it doesn't come up on the show, our major sweeping criticism last week, and indeed the last however many months, is that they are kind of taking the piss with how contrived everything feels on the show. The more contrived things that happen on the show, the more it feels like a show, the more it feels like WWE. There were two backstage segments, which were kind of nothing segments, obligatory ways to build future matches that he's doing or to further feuds that are ongoing. But it's the way they're framed, it's vital to this. You want it to be perfect. You want it to feel perfect. You want to feel immersed in it. You want it to feel it's real. The constant interruptions, we've talked a lot about peeling the roof off and everyone's just, all the heels are like lurking about. It's a ridiculous scene if you think about it for more than 5 seconds. There were two backstage segments here. One was interrupted, but it actually felt a little bit hot and it felt a little bit like a transgression when Layla Hirsch did it.
And it would make sense for her to be there.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But beyond that, there were two segments that no one will praise, except me, because I'm a pedantic dork, but these things matter. Anna Jay and Jade Cargill, to build their match, were simply stood next to one another. No one interrupted. They were simply stood next to one another in the first place, as if it was just like a little bit of a boxer UFC fighter.
Like they were instructed to be there. You got to be there for 10:15 for your big showdown.
Yeah,
like as if that's your job.
You need to promote your match. Yeah. You need to promote your fight.
We signed it. We'll do this. This almost before we'll do a face off photo or something. Let's have a little chat. Yeah,
like all combat sports fights get promoted. The way to do it is to do it realistically, as in combat sports. This was just close enough for me to think, great, fantastic. This was not the only thing they did to experiment with a format that they realized that they got buried for and they listened to in some way correct it. Because when Lee Moriarty, Matt Sydal, and Dante Martin were interviewed, they had their comments, and then they threw to Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs to respond, rather than have Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs be the 15th act to interrupt another act. There were certain interruptions on the show, but if you measure it correctly, you make it feel less fake and less contrived and less overbooked.
Yeah, completely agree. This was not the best Dynamite ever, but it felt like it in the sense that it arrested what felt like a slide. AEW has made what once felt great to have back normal. So when you're constantly striving for perfect with AEW, that bar sort of gets raised. Mm. So what was once perfect is now established and is the norm. So now it's like, well, what else is perfect? What else can you fix? What else can you tweak? And that's hard enough, not least when you feel like you're entering a bit of a creative downswing, or there's a feeling of like laziness or sloppiness or all those things creeping in that we've talked about on a few podcasts lately. And this, yeah, in listening and attempting to, what felt to me like directly address some of them as well. Who knows if our complaints or the complaints of some of the other like media or commentariat reflects the wider audience. like we like to think we represent a portion of it, but we don't know that for definite. But it certainly felt like it must have been felt internally.
Yes.
For them to want to make some of them very, very direct and obvious changes throughout this specific broadcast. Really pleasing. And like away from all of that, as a standalone episode, like solid and at times great.
Yeah.
So like, and that for a spell last summer was the minimum expectation for Dynamite.
Yeah.
So let's get back to that being what we want at least of a Wednesday night.
My key phrase before we go into the actual segment by segment rundown is at times AEW Dynamite is episodic to a fault. They are constantly shooting things. The more angles you shoot, the more it gets removed from the fact that lad, it's meant to be a sports league with some fixtures. Wrestlers hate each other. This drives conflict. I'm not an idiot. But the more you do it, the more it feels redundant and fake. The ending to the show was simply a happy ending where a really well-received babyface team defeats these dickhead heels who are trying to have a go at them. And they simply celebrated because the match ended.
I was genuinely shocked by that. I was like, oh, they're just going to stand and be happy in the ring. No,
no stables, no Rampage match to plug, nothing like that. Just done.
Yeah,
like it's completed for this week. On it next week.
Yeah. Just a quick point out as well as I always say at What Culture WWE, at Michael Hanfler, at M Sidrick, at Adam Wilborn. If you want to direct your apologies towards us for obviously our correct take last week, then feel free to do that. Exactly. A vast improvement on last week, in my opinion. This show still not perfect, without question. Some issues that we will dive into as we go through the show. But yeah, night and day compared to last week. And whilst I am talking about Twitter, I should give a huge shout out to Kyle Feldscher, who went along to the show last night with a couple of brilliant signs. One that simply says, mega fan, with an arrow pointing to himself. And one that says, huge bap.
Huge bap.
So thank you to Kyle for that.
What an incredibly respectable guy he is as well.
I know.
Incredibly prominent guy sometimes who somehow likes our weird stuff. Like, it's class.
Yeah, and also, I forgot to mention him yesterday, so I'm going to mention him now. Shout out to Chef Coley, who had us on for his 5.5-hour drive home yesterday, so thank you as always for joining us for that, and hopefully this will keep you entertained today because we've got a lot to get into on this Dynamite review.
Are we better than 5-Hour Energy? Is that official now? Or any stupid products that JBL used to shill? Our podcasts are better than them.
Let me just check the charts. Well, right. So we started obviously with the return of Jon Moxley. Fantastic, obviously, to see him back in an AEW ring after all that he's gone through at the end of last year and the start of this one. Wild Thing opens the show. Of course, you kind of had to open it with this. He gets a huge reaction, welcome back chant. He's walking through this crowd who just adore him. Except for one knobhead who thought it was a good idea to heckle him. I'm not even going to give what he said a mention here. He said something absolutely stupid and was told, quite rightly, to go fuck himself by Jon Moxley, who told them to get this dumbass out of there. You've gone all that way, you've paid all that money, and you've seen a minute.
He's probably a fed-pilled mutant, if I'm being honest.
Why do it, though? Why go? Like, if I don't like something, just don't look at it. It's not difficult.
This is a thing now, isn't it? You were telling me about this.
Yeah, like, there's various...
sign last week.
There's various Cornette cult idiots who pay pretty sizable sums of money to sit prominently at ringside and display signs of anti-AEW sentiment. What an absolute bunch of losers.
Odd behaviour.
I mean, honestly, it goes down to the point I've been trying to make and I've been trying to maintain of like punching down, where they wouldn't say these things to our faces or, I mean, Jon Moxley's faces, but at a safe distance. I wouldn't say, oh, you're an unfulfilled loser in real life, because if you picture the person behind the keyboard, then you'll be revolted probably.
And like, just as on the off chance that we're catching crossover listeners that listen to Cornette and us, take signs, just take ones about our podcast.
Yeah, that's fine. You wouldn't be revolted. Right. That's wrong of me to say. You would just feel... You wouldn't tell what kind of person they are from what they look like. That should be absolutely addressed first and foremost. But if you've got a peek into their lives, it can't be fulfilling. It can't be happy. Like, no. Just ignore them.
It's funny because I was thinking, like, oh, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? What is this version of Jon Moxley going to be like? He looked, obviously, everyone's been sharing on Twitter today, there's a sort of before and after of all this and what a difference this has all made. But thinking, like, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? Oh, cool. So it's the same old John Moxley. Like, we haven't lost anything but we loved about him all those months ago. Anyway, he cuts this promo. He talks about a while ago, he landed in a city, doesn't remember it. He was on the side of the road, hands and knees in the dirt, a black cloud hanging over him, the kind that follows you for years, he said. Everyone has them. He said, this cloud, it's like a demon. It's laughing at him. He says, everything that you have that's good, none of that, it belongs to you. Where do you even get off? Do you really think you were going to make it out? And he said he woke up before he could answer. He said, look, we all carry scars, but the ones on the inside are harder to see. We try and cover them, but we should be proud of them. They tell our story, he says. These scars make us the people we are. No one is perfect, and that's him. He's sure there are plenty of people somewhere who want to write him off, who doubt him. And it won't be the first time or the last time. Go ahead and say what you want. Think what you want. He'll tell them what he told the cloud. Take all that shiz and shove it up your ass. He doesn't run from demons. He just beats the shiz out of them. For everyone that supported him, thank you. Buckle up. 2022 will be a pilgrimage, Moxley says. He will grab the world of professional wrestling by the balls. Because now, more than ever...
Tony D'Ambrose.
He is truly free. And he said he's thirsty, but all these days, all he drinks, Michael Sidgwick, is blood.
Right. That line... That will stick with me for a long, long time, if not forever. We were previewing this show. Obviously, it's redundant now, but, you know, if you want to give us another listen, you can do so wherever you get your podcast from. But we were trying to gauge how this was going to go and what we wanted from it. And I think we arrived somewhere between the middle. It's like, you want to know the real-life person is good, but in a greedy way because we loved him so much, you kind of want to see that John Moxley is back. You want the performer and the man. How does he strike that balance? Because John Moxley's a goddamn poet, who can get across in a short promo more than virtually anybody else can get across in a long one. He tells you that the man, Jonathan Good, and the performer, John Moxley, are back at the same time in four incredibly badass, iconic words that could go on a goddamn T-shirt like that. I only drink blood is him saying, I've kicked it. I'm happy that I've kicked it. Be assured that I'm well now. Also, I'm the hardest guy and the best John Carpenter protagonist who never was. I just couldn't get over how awesome that line was. The guy's absolutely incredible. It was great to see him in absolutely astonishing shape. This was genuinely uplifting stuff. Like John Moxley, as we said throughout 2020, when we knew that the ones you'd like to think were good, were not. You'll never know for sure. John Moxley is one of the very select few you just simply know are the good guys. And to see him in this healthy space in his life was just incredible.
Yeah, like really stirring stuff. Found myself welling up, and I think I would have out and out gone if Eddie Kingston had joined him for a hug at the end or something like that. What a man and what a moment this was as a wrestling promo. And just on that very quickly, there was quite appropriate, I guess, synergy with the CM Punk return. You know, considering the subject matter, they should be like worlds apart, but yes. Instead they felt very much close together. And just quite awesome that AEW is the stage for these performers to have these moments. There is a precedent quickly being set that when times like these come along, wrestlers can have this ring to do this instead of it being exploited for storyline purposes or instead of it being cheapened in the way that other promotions, and not just WWE, by the way, wrestling historically,
yes,
would cheapen these things. AEW is doing it differently. This is change the world stuff. Genuinely, this way of dealing with these things. The ability of the performers to blend the fact with the fiction helps exponentially, because when you can do that, it obviously joins the two worlds together without feeling a little bit detached. Moxley, as Cedric points out, was always going to be perfect at that. That element of this, I think, was never in doubt, was it? And as the comparison to the pandemic is apt, who better to talk about the trials of life than John Moxley? He did it when the world needed it most, and now we were there to listen when he did. And what was so great, you pointed out, Wilborn, you said, you know, John Moxley comes back and he's still John Moxley. That's addiction. He's got this forever. So he's himself before, during, and after this addiction. And what a better way to yet again relate to the people through the screen that might be going through those same struggles, big or small. Talks about the scars on the inside and all that sort of thing. Surely everybody sat there and felt at one with John Moxley in that moment. And they're going to do that for the rest of his life on screen, mm-hmm, because they know what he's going to battle. Just like, this is moving wrestling forward. This is moving conversation forward. And there are a few people better than the likes of John Moxley and Eddie Kingston to do it. I love him. Yeah. I love John Moxley. Like, very, very deeply love John Moxley.
And the only thing I thought that was missing, and I didn't want an interruption or, you know, an attack or anything like that, was like, ah, oh, it's a shame we're not going to get a match with him soon, like on Rampage or something. And then they fix that later on.
Yeah, this is preview fodder, but what a perfect opponent.
Yeah.
Ideal.
Absolutely perfect.
I mean, he's opponent. Insane for offering him out, but yeah.
Who's the actual man of the year? John Moxley.
Yeah. No.
Right, we go backstage. We'll talk about that in due course, of course. We go backstage because there is MJF. Wardlow is behind him. Again, just in terms of the shot, perfect. Maxwell's directing everything down the lens to us, and Wardlow's reacting over his shoulder, and you don't really know who to focus on. Max says, last week was an abomination. Punk should have taken the loss on the chin like a man, but he rolled up Wardlow, effectively implying, like, a little bit of a bitch. And he said, but yeah, you know, if granted, if Wardlow had a little bit more seasoning, he would have, or he should have, reversed it. But that, hey, that's not what he's here to do. He's here to apologise to Wardlow. It's his birthday, Sige. And he lost his cool last week. That's not okay. But Wardlow did put his hands on MJF, and unfortunately, hands are tied a bit there. He can't allow that. It pains him to do this, but handful it, he's going to have to dock MJF's pay. He's going to have to dock Wardlow's pay, apologies. But hey, if he racks up some wins and he gets that TNT title back, hey, he'll get his money back. He believes in Wardlow, and he believes in Spears too. Spears is going to get the job done. He's better than you. Puts his arm round Wardlow, and you know it.
It's great fun with what we know is to come, obviously, the match itself. MJF taking money out of Wardlow's birthday card is absolutely incredible. Hours after he wished R-Truth a happy birthday on Twitter, by the way, he went to Wikipedia and wrestler birthdays in order to find somebody, not Wardlow, to wish many happy returns to.
I saw that tweet and went, what's he? Oh, yeah, I got it.
Incredible. We're in the hot space of the Batista is giving Triple H every look. Diesel's getting sick of Shawn Michaels. Pick your example, because this is kind of the coolest moment. I don't want to ruin the fun for people, but this is actually the best bit of the story. Having lived through these before.
I mean, you'd be texting about Bailey and Sasha this.
Yeah, like the turn is always great, but when you know it's coming, this is the best bit, man. The looks, the little side eyes, the point at which MJF... always the smartest guy in the room, always one step ahead of us with taking the money out of the card in this case and all the various other things with CM Punk, but finally one step behind somebody, and he's one step behind the guy that's going to absolutely destroy him one of these days. We talked yesterday on how Wardlow might factor into the match, and we couldn't really land on something that we were all particularly happy with. Clearly, nor could AEW. This was loads better. What a solution to... it wasn't a problem, but what a solution to this little creative situation they found themselves in.
This is pretty much a perfect... low-key perfect segment of pro wrestling television. If there's one flaw in this entire thing, it's Wardlow, why are you taking so long to do the turn? Because you know this guy's a piece of trash. You know he's using you. You know the crowd are behind you. You know they have, you have their support. You know you're getting over. You know you want to break free. So MJF being a little bit nice to him, out of character, it's probably the nicest he's been, sincerely, to a degree, on AEW Dynamite TV so far. You kind of got a little glimpse into the fact that, oh, you know, they probably share the same car, and they probably chat on the road. They probably have established a bit of a friendship at this point. So there's a little layer to it that kind of, they're getting away with something in the best possible way of the one tiny little thing that you could sort of unhook and the whole thing would unravel. So that was great. Wardlow's understated facial expressions continue to be incredible. There's such a range on such a handsome face as well.
Oh.
There's such a range to it as well. There's times when he's kind of looking a little bit like, oh, you complete cock. I'm quietly putting up with you. You're a complete cock. And then there was one genuinely exhilarating moment when he kind of like cracks his neck and stares at him as if to say, I'm seconds away from powerbombing you right here, right now. And then he kind of just peels it back. And he's incredible. Like the misnomer with Wardlow is that, oh, he's got this incredible meathead energy. And he does. That's one of the reasons why people gravitate towards him. This is a guy who will bellow at the top of his lungs, who's the fucking man. But he's also like one of the most low-key intelligent storytellers in the entire goddamn industry. I can't wait for the turn when it happens.
I was thinking as well, basically what MJF has done here is kind of like dragged Wardlow through a HR procedural, isn't he? Because he's his employer. He still pays him. I really, really want, after the turn, like that night when Wardlow finally snaps and turns, Tony Khan to tweet, "I'm pleased to offer Wardlow a contract. Wardlow's all elite," and the graphics come up. So not only is he just freed himself, but he's also got the financial security to completely batter it. Like, there needs be no recrimination, no regret. Like, something like that, just to sort of confirm that he doesn't need MJF's money, he's not on the payroll, and there is nothing linking him to him anymore.
Are you saying he could say a promo along the lines of, let's just say, "I don't need you anymore, Maxwell"?
I said need, and I knew where it was going, and I just...
You fool!
Push the words back in. Come on.
Then we got the mixed tag match. It was Adam Cole and Britt Baker versus Orange Cassidy and Chris Statlander. Chris and Britt start the match off, and Britt Baker immediately tags out. And obviously that means the men have to come in. Cole comes in, they square up, and Cole immediately tags out, which means it's got to go back to Britt Baker and Chris Statlander. So Britt Baker comes in, Orange Cassidy goes, "I don't think I will." And he does the lazy kicks on Britt Baker, and the crowd love it, but she responds by stomping on his foot, and he tags Chris Statlander in. Statlander actually gets the better of Britt Baker early on. She gets this nice delayed vertical suplex that Orange Cassidy helps with pushing it over. And they take Cole and Baker out at ringside, but unfortunately, they celebrate too long. That allows Cole and Baker to hit them with super kicks and have a lovely kiss ahead of the commercial break. When we come back, Orange Cassidy just gets to Chris Statlander for the hot tag. She comes in, runs wild, hits a blue thunder bomb. That gets a two count. Baker fights back, though, gets a cradle, hits a neck breaker. Cole and Cassidy come back in. Cole hits an enziguri, but Orange comes back with the Stundog Millionaire. Baker, in amongst all this, gets a blind tag, curb stomps Orange Cassidy, but then in comes Chris Statlander and cuts her off. She goes up top. Britt Baker is laid out next to the turnbuckle, and Adam Cole thinks, "Ha ha, I've got the better of you here." He covers his girlfriend to protect her and says, "Well, you can't do anything there." And she goes, "Yeah, I can," and hits a 450. I think it's called the Area 451, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Onto both of them, which was just sensational. Orange hits the beach break on Cole. Really good near fall off the back of this. Orange wants to hit him with the orange punch, and Cole gets out onto the ramp. Orange Cassidy goes after him, and let's be honest, completely botches the dive over the top ropes, and allegedly it's a super kick. Regardless, Cole wants to hit him with the Panama Sunrise, but Statlander pushes Orange Cassidy back into the ring. Baker blindsides a super kick, hits a Canadian Destroyer on the ramp. Back in the ring, Cole hits the Panama Sunrise on Orange Cassidy, gets a near fall, but can't believe that he hasn't got the pinfall victory there. So him and Baker set up the timekeeper's table, take it sort of from close to ringside to right next to the ring, basically. In amongst all this, Baker's on the apron. Cole's getting back in. Orange Cassidy goes for the orange punch. Cole gets out of the way, and Orange Cassidy accidentally hits Britt Baker. She falls and goes through the table, and whilst the doctors are checking on her and the referee's distracted with all this, Adam Cole low blows Orange Cassidy, hits him with the boom, and gets the victory for him and his girlfriend.
I just had a beaming smile on my face when I saw Orange Cassidy do the leg kicks to Britt Baker. The whole idea is Tony Khan doesn't want to do intergender wrestling. I endorse that, to be completely frank. I don't want to open up that can of goddamn worms on this podcast. But I just don't really want to see it, personally. So they do Orange Cassidy doing it to Britt Baker, which is, oh my God, the invention there was incredible. They can subvert it. If there's any men's rights activists who are furiously hammering their fists into their keypads right now, why is it all right for a woman to hit a man? Like, touch grass. I've never once said that earnestly. I'm saying it right now. Go and goddamn touch grass. Read some goddamn statistics, huh? And so that put a massive smile on my face, as did the vast majority of this match, even though I love Chris Statlander. She needs to retire that weird apron shooting style that she does.
Oh, yeah. That was when Cassidy just sort of fell off the apron.
Heart in mouth moment. Like,
there is simply not enough space to land it in a way that doesn't make you feel anxious, that convincingly sort of flattens the opponent. There's just not enough space to do it.
Does
to
it
stop
justify,
it.
Like, the... Like grazing clothesline that you hit as well. It's a lot to do for what is a fact. You could just run off the apron and hit that clothesline.
You'd think someone who comes from outer space would have an idea of how much space there is. And there's very little to execute that move. That was the one time I was taken out of it where I thought, oh, it's just silly. That is just silly. There was some genuinely good drama in this. I thought it was laid out very, very well. I know some people have qualms about the tag in and out, but for me, it builds suspense and it's sort of, it's like smoke and mirrors because they're always tagging out. You think, oh, well, you're not going to see, you know, Chris Statlander do anything to Adam Cole because it's not permitted within the parameters of the rules, which gets over that 451 spot so well. And I thought they played with the tags in and out to build to that really quite nicely. The crowd were hot for it. The Baker and Cole act, like, I wouldn't want to, you know, I don't really want to see it as a long-term thing, but if it's something they're really prepared to do and the crowd are up for it, I don't really have any complaints about it. The storytelling with Orange Cassidy, I thought, was the strongest attribute of this match, which is where Hamlet and I disagree. I love the idea that Orange Cassidy, who was in the Best Friends stable, has this wholesome character attribute wherein he's a lazy slacker. He's smarter than you think, and sometimes he does it as strategy, but he's a lazy guy. That's his whole shtick. As a member of the Best Friends stable, he just wants to root behind his friend, and he believes in his friend, and he encourages his friend. That is the kind of wholesome thing that can penetrate even my charred husk of humanity. The way they arrived at yet another Adam Cole Orange Cassidy showdown was really well done, I thought. And I think Orange Cassidy in a lights out match, the contrast between persona and stipulation, if it isn't special, I think they are, it'll be a complete failure. If he doesn't get literal juice, like claret, all over his face and fire up and create an iconic like Scott Lesh or who's the guy from The Observer who does the great photos as well?
Speedy Lee.
Speedy Lee does good ones as well. It's a guy from The Observer who got kicked out of the NXT shows because that company's complete trash. Yeah. JJ something. I don't know. I really apologize, but he shoots some great snaps as well. If they don't have Orange Cassidy, whites of his eyes, covered in blood, doing something awesome in a fire-up comeback spot, because I just think there's so much potential there. But this all built towards it really quite tremendously, I thought, and I had a great time watching it.
Yeah, I'll get your thoughts on the match and the forthcoming match, because
Kimber last kick as well.
Yeah.
Did the Becky Lynch stuff, didn't she?
Adam Cole, subsequent to this, there's a bit in between what we'll talk about in a second. He cuts a promo. He's furious. He said, look, Orange Cassidy's been a thorn in his side. And then he goes and puts his hands on his girlfriend. What more do I need to do? And he said, how about next Wednesday, beach break, Cole versus Orange Cassidy, no DQ, lights out match. He promised to end Orange's career. Thoughts on that and the match?
While I remember, while we're bouncing off the Adam Cole promo, this is never not great. And me and Cedric always celebrate the Cody singing and firing champagne everywhere while Brandy's suffering the consequences of the injury she suffered in the match. But Adam Cole saying that after going, ref, ref, and screaming to get him away from looking after Britt to count the fall, to then go out, he's like, well, match first. We're at work. I'll come and see you in a minute. So, like, that, like really good heel stuff.
Why are you ringing me at 9:10?
I feel bad for how I feel about Orange Cassidy in this role because I like Sidgwick's take. Like, we do disagree, but I like the take. I like that ultimately one of the things, it's not just Sidgwick's husk, it's kind of Orange Cassidy's husk, his slacker husk, that it can be penetrated by friendship. That's really nice. I believe that more than I believe half of the Best Friends act, quite honestly. I just feel a bit uncomfortable watching Orange Cassidy do it. That's always been the way. I want to see him...
Not the way.
I want to see him fire up and keep his glasses on and his hands in his pockets. And I never want to see it progress past that point. And when it does, I sometimes feel a bit awkward watching it. I think sometimes it veers. I didn't think he was very convincing as the, oh my God, what have I become? I've put a woman through a table. And that's only a split second of reacting, but I find it a bit cringeworthy. I think the match will be totally different. Like the lights out match, he's going to be perfect in that. He is quite good at summoning violence when he needs to. He showed, the feud wasn't great, but he showed good flashes of anger against Chris Jericho. That were probably forgotten because a lot of that went down the silly route and it was just something to fill the silence of the empty arena. But within the matches, there were times when he knew how to like get serious and get furious. So I think the lights out match will be great. Cole will know how to work around all of the early stuff where Orange Cassidy's still being Orange Cassidy before it gets all very serious and violent. This match was fun. I like this. I don't know if it was inventive as I maybe hoped for. There were a few points where it was a little bit stilted and you kind of felt them moving from one spot to the next. And, you know, mixed tag matches don't look the easiest to construct. How often these all four get to work with each other, you know, you can understand a little bit of that. But at the same time, you've got a week. They're all pros. They all know the characters really well. You can have a higher bar that you maybe expect from that. What I will say, and this, again, huge difference from Dynamite last week and maybe other weeks or even where this goes on this episode. A great Dynamite is like Christmas every day, and the mood was right. Because I was in such a great mood off the start of the promo and the MJF stuff that I was way happier with this than I would have been on a weaker show. It does, we've always said this, AEW is a vibes promotion more than anything else, and they'd established a really, really good one, and something way worse than this would have got a pass.
JJ Williams.
Yes.
Yeah.
From I think
some incredible Malachi Black photos.
Was like attended NXT for like 5-6 years, didn't
they? Yeah, and they got booted out. A complete dickhead company.
Right, we're backstage and they're talking about the fact that it's going to be Daniel Garcia and 2.0 facing the Inner Circle. Jericho doesn't care regarding Eddie Kingston. He can GFY as far as he's concerned.
As pointed out by Andrew Rich on Twitter, it is so goddamn funny that John Moxley, he didn't try to steal Jericho's heat. He was reacting like anyone would at his most vulnerable moment to a complete twat. It's actually said, go fuck yourself. And poor Jericho's trying to do rooty tooty booty in a feud with Eddie Kingston. And it's just, I mean, he deserves it. Deserves it for how bad the pattern is.
Doing a promo drill with Steve Austin saying, I'm going to kick your bum.
GFY, man. God, so goddamn lame. Turn him heel.
Stop trying to get GFY happening. It's not going to happen.
How can he come up with such great patter sometimes, Jericho, and then just think that's good?
There's a little guy in there. Chris Jericho said that.
Yeah, no.
But anyway, he's saying he doesn't care about Eddie Kingston. And Santana and Ortiz aren't happy about this. Ortiz says, well, we care about Kingston. Tread carefully when you mention his name. He says, look, maybe he's got a point. Maybe Kingston did have a point, says Santana, that maybe you're the reason we aren't tag champions. You know, we've always been there to fight your battles, but when have you got our back? Maybe next week we're going to prove that we don't need you to win. Maybe next week we'll focus more on us instead of this. You feel me? And Jericho concludes by saying, no, I don't feel you.
Jesus Christ. I do love the idea that, because I've said for a while, the idea of having so many stables in AEW opens up sprawling narrative opportunities. You can go bam, 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 bam before you get to the destination match. At some point, you have to think, all right, this is convenient for Tony Khan's booking, but what does it do for my career? So you have to get inside the heads of the characters and you think, are they just happy doing run-ins? Do they want to pursue titles? Chuffed a bit that this has been acknowledged within the Inner Circle after all this time. I love the idea of Santana and Ortiz potentially not even tagging Jericho into the trios match. That's a nice little hook that they could potentially do. The problem with everything continues to be Chris Jericho. Well, I feel Shan. This guy's entertained me for so many years, but when he's bad, he's really bad.
Yeah. This felt incredibly rushed. But Jericho's been so bad lately that, it was too cathartic for anyone to really care. For all that we've been watching and observing, why are they sticking with this guy? It's never once been acknowledged on AEW television that there's been a problem at all. And then they've done it over the course of one promo, and they've obviously acknowledged the relationship with Eddie Kingston and used that. And I will actually give them a little bit of credit here. Just because we've been critical of why, the real why Chris Jericho is feuding with Eddie Kingston, it doesn't mean that AEW aren't now being creative in a kayfabe sense with how this is going to splinter the Inner Circle, which is how this is, the overlapping relationships with Kingston. And I like that. I really do like that. And I like that they're getting where they need to go. It's just, they just went from 0 to 100 with it, didn't they? the Inner Circle has been, this isn't Bullet Club is fine. Inner Circle's been proper fine. And then all of a sudden Power Powerful gone, oh yeah, we're not. This has been a problem for 8 months. Over the course of 1 second backstage. Bit weird, but glad we're where we are.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That was followed by CM Punk versus Sean Spears, a lot briefer than we anticipated. Before the match can begin, MJF comes out and teases, maybe even coming out to ringside, but then joins commentary and is very excited about watching Sean Spears defeat CM Punk. That didn't happen. In like 10 seconds, Punk grappled with him, got him up, hit the GTS and pinned him. Post-match, as Punk is sort of effectively saying, well, I've beaten everyone, you're next sort of thing. He's celebrating. He goes up on the turnbuckle that's facing away from the commentary table and the ramp. And MJF sees his opportunity, slithers down to the ring. But Punk's got eyes in the back of his head and, turns around, squares off with MJF, who goes to bail. Punk grabs him by the Burberry scarf and MJF gets out of the scarf, leaves it behind. Punk is just left there holding the scarf and MJF suddenly looks like maybe he regrets everything that he's done. What did you make of this? Not something we predicted, a squash, effectively, for CM Punk.
I like the Breakfast Club reference. Is that the Breakfast Club?
The thing that's got...
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Quite enjoyed that.
Didn't pick that up.
Quite enjoyed that. I also really enjoyed this, directly and indirectly. Wilbur, I'm trying not to subtweet you here, right? But sometimes you've got to be a little bit more patient. Because when you see a result like Punk versus Wardlow last week, and you consider it like within the real like tapestry of everything going on between Punk, Spears, Wardlow, MJF, you do something like this week and create a comparison between, well, Wardlow's miles above Spears. It should not be like just another running buddy of MJF's. They've created a wonderful comparison between Spears and Wardlow here, which furthers the idea of Wardlow's like, what am I doing dicking about with this idiot? I nearly beat this guy, this legend, and he's just killed you in like 5 seconds because you're a pissant, like...
He had his foot in his chest.
Absolutely.
MJF told him to take it off, so yeah.
Absolutely. So I love that direct parallel between last week. Again, sometimes you just have to let it play out, Wilborn. Yeah. Do you understand what I'm saying to you right now?
Listen to Alexa Bliss.
So I love that. I also love the idea, right, that people want this match desperately. They are being made to wait. This kind of, at this point, they've ran into a corner. Or so they are making you feel like they've run into a corner. Well, he's beat Sean Spears in 5 seconds. He's already beaten Wardlow just. We've run out of guys. He's already beat FTR at Holiday Bash. That's it. He's gone through the pinnacle. But Beach Break's loaded. Can't do it next week. Revolution's still a little bit far away. Can't do it then. They have to now engineer a reason because CM Punk can come out next week and say, right, I've beaten the last guy that you put in front of us. It's time. You need to stop running.
Is there, just off the top of my head, tell me if I'm wrong here, and I'll look into it whilst we're talking about it. Is Dynamite in 2 weeks in Chicago?
Yes. Oh, so it could be then.
So next week, oh, let's have it out. Fine, okay.
Do you see the Road 2?
No, I didn't see the Road 2 actually this
week. The Road 2 was really good. They wrong-footed you about the Sean Spears CM Punk match in the best way. CM Punk said, sooner or later, you're going to have to fight me, and it might just be in the worst place.
That was on the video package again.
Yeah,
before
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So either it's happening in Chicago, and they're going to do a stepped-up rematch at Revolution, presumably. Dog collar, I called it. Or they've put something in front of the storyline, with the idea being that they can then pull it back and then do another twist that none of us geeks can see coming. Either getting the match, or you're getting a fantastic reason why it's not happening yet, because he's... MJF appears to have run out of road, but has he?
I think the reason, if it's not going to happen, needs to be really well thought through as well. Just on this angle, like a terrific,
like episodic week for this story. The Heat never.
It's fantastic, the storyline.
Yeah, like the Heat never once subsided from the moment Spears came out through to the very end when CM Punk's nicking his scarf, no matter how miserable Jim Ross sounded about that. Like, it was just a really great little, like, a segment.
That's a real forbidden door, criticising JR's commentary.
a segment of television more than a match, obviously. But episodic television, as we've seen loads lately, is not easy. And the Heat was there throughout this extended angle. They had that match go so quick that you thought, are we actually going to get some sort of brawl here? Because CM Punk is still fit as a fiddle. He's not having to sell any of the match. And they didn't have to give you it because obviously they know where they're going with this. The one, it's not a criticism particularly, but the one thing I would like them to address as part of the when and where and the how of the match, the singles match they're going to have. So we know that MJF takes the contractually obligated dates and typically likes to take the easy matches, just does what he absolutely has to. I'm not advocating for Tony Khan to come out on the stage and give it the big 9 days. However, MJF does seem to have a lot of booking stroke. He's basically called all of CM Punk shots for the last few weeks. Flip that and give CM Punk, give him the pencil. Like, how, what I'm asking is, how has MJF had the access to be able to book these matches?
Yeah.
And CM Punk, fair enough, he's accepted them because he's a babyface, but not really had any say in this. It would be quite nice now for Punk somehow to have arrived at that position of power and be able to say, yeah, like, you have run out of road and now I call the shots, and next week in Chicago, I've been to Tony Khan. Or, you know, however MJF has got these, can't Punk get them too? It's not, is it?
Let it play out.
Yeah, it's not even a plot hole. It's just, I'm looking at it and thinking, well, all of this has happened because MJF has said so.
It is a device. A babyface can't say no.
Yeah.
And a booker will exploit the hell out of this. Maybe that's just a wrestling thing.
Mm.
For me, this is where the show took a turn, if I'm honest. Billy Gunn has commandeered a cameraman.
What a lot. Like, I just want to say, and look, I know that
an effort was made at least.
It was.
Yeah.
I'm at fault for this because I'm a mug that stays awake sometimes. But believe me, you do not want to hear the line, Billy Gunn has commandeered a cameraman, when you look at the clock and it says 1:43 a.m. That will stick with me for a very, very long time, that moment, that very specific line. Like,
in watching it live going, skip.
Like, never mind Pete's done, like Hamlet's done. I don't care about the odd invisible camera. I just don't. The level of, like, Billy Gunn's, like, booked a camera crew. He's waiting outside the building for Christian Cage. He's like, right, if I'm going to do this, I've got to come up with a line that's going to come up with Christian's line to justify why the boys are there ready to attack him. It's weird. Like, it's just, that's more fake feeling than just, oh, look, we're seeing something that's happening backstage. Sometimes you just don't think about why you're seeing the thing backstage, but they're telling you so much. It's like, why am I watching this?
So, yeah, Christian's walking into the arena and Billy Gunn does the old good afternoon when your mate walks into work 10 minutes late or whatever. it's nice you just show up sort of thing. And he says, look, you know, my boys are top five as well. I don't know, I haven't seen them for months, but still. They're top five. We should get a top shot at your boys' tag team titles. And Cage says, yeah, fair. Look, your boys, they're talented. They've got your genes. Big, strong, fast. But, you know, when the lights were brightest, you could never really get that statement win. If you maybe make a statement, then we'll talk. And this, of course, brings in the rest of the Gun Club to attack Christian Cage. They triple team him, chuck him into a sliding door and leave him laying, basically.
What podcast do you think somebody with an AEW listened to that thought, you know what, we need to get Christian and Billy Gunn sharing screen together? I can't imagine this week where somebody would have happened upon that idea within the corridors of power within AEW. Thanks for the subscribe, as always.
Billy Bitch Cakes.
I mean, Jesus Christ. This comes back around to another point. Tony Khan, in aggressively expanding his roster, signing people you would be stupid not to sign, has put himself in a corner. If you look at the complexion of the tag team division and specifically the heels in it,
he's run out of roads.
He's run out of roads. He can't beat FTR again. You can beat FTR again, right? You can beat FTR. You can have Jurassic Express beat FTR on like a featured Dynamite after another long storyline between those two. Because I think you can beat FTR, right? And then at some point, FTR will have to say, we haven't been the same since the Young Bucks beat us. Mm. And then that's the perfect way to arrive at that feud again, which I'm desperate to see more of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's one team you can beat potentially at Revolution, right? I know FTR are in the rankings, but Brody King's great and available. Let's sign him. Let's do House of Black. Can't beat them yet. Let's get Kyle O'Reilly. He's available. He's great. Right. Red Dragon. Can't beat them yet. Gun Club. What? Like, it's so, you have to beat someone at some point. Otherwise, you get segments of television like this. And I understand that you get segments of television like this so that something like Jurassic Express versus Red Dragon or Kings of the Black Throne feels really cool when it does happen because it's premium. I'm just... Sometimes I'm impatient. And I'm usually impatient when the Gun Club are on screen, if I'm being perfectly honest. They're not... If you think about the Pillars conversation, right, you've got Jungle Boy and all the rest of the Pillars. Then you've got that subgroup underneath of, like, oh, Dante Martin. And you've got Ricky Starks. And you've got Daniel Garcia. Has anyone ever said, oh, Austin Gunn, potential Pillar? Like, I'm not being funny. No one has.
Me, well, only when the building he was holding up was Daly's place.
Yes.
Like... I've got no interest in this match. And I know it's going to pass by for 8 minutes on Rampage and I won't care and I will not be offended, but look at that division. Let it interact with itself, for God's sake.
I think the question to ask, and we all know the answer to it, is that the Dark Order were never going to win the belts, but who was more likely to have the more entertaining match? So this is, in effect, a backward step as a viewer. Not only do you not believe in the result...
It's an Al Snow match.
Yeah,
it's got no redeeming qualities. You know that infamous shoot interview, yes, where it's like, by your own logic, you've never had a good match. Like,
shout out to Ian going by the pseudonym of Neville Southall.
Absolutely tremendous. This is kind of a little bit like that, and it's like, well, there's no good to come of this, is there?
Yeah,
you're not going to get a great match, and you're not going to believe there's a title switch. Like, one or the other.
Yeah, it's fair.
But instead, none.
Now it is time for Cody Rhodes' pipe bomb. He comes out to...
Pipe bombs.
Yeah. He comes out to a mixed reaction, I think it's fair to say. And also, I was watching this and didn't realise we'd gone to picture-in-picture as he was making his entrance. On my thing, it was just obviously they just keep it on. And I was thinking, he is taking his sweet time getting this ladder from underneath the ring, isn't he? So he does, but thankfully, apparently that was in commercial. Thank you to both of you two who pointed that out to me, because I was like, dragged that out a bit, didn't he? But he sets up this ladder in the ring.
Imagine if he'd done it first for like the 15-minute no commercial block. He's just like, goes into business for himself a little bit. Going to really make people care about his ladder.
And he gets in the ring and says, what's in the news? What's in the news? You heard about this? You wanna... No, he says to the fans, what do you want to talk about? And he said he was reminded from that last match about a man who once sat on a stage, looked into a ring, and gave one of the most important addresses in the history of our sport that inspired thousands, mobilized millions, and was the first hint of a revolution, CM Punk and the pipe bomb. He said someone told him to save it, but he's doing this promo now. In that interview, that was the first whiff of a revolution. He laid out a roadmap. He listed things that were taboo at the time, things like going to New Japan, working with Ring of Honor, teaming with the Young Bucks. As destiny would have it, Cody said he was unable to do those things, but he would eventually join AEW in a not only a comeback of the year, but potentially the comeback of the decade. We're all living and loving it. He looks at the ladder he's just put up, and he says, look, Punk's absence, someone did each and every one of those things that he said. And that man was Cody Rhodes. He said he brought the revolution, and each and every one of you cheered. Why won't he turn heel? Because they cheered him when he needed it the most. He said that the audience, we are the royal family that he refers to. People talk about the Forbidden Door, he said... Before there was a forbidden door, he was the one who built it. He said, look, I've been gone. I've been gone for a couple of weeks. I see it. Look, the Young Bucks almost started the Wednesday night wars all over again. Doesn't need to see the Young Bucks beat developmental again. He says, Starks is out here dealing with Jay Lethal. Puts over Jay Lethal's finisher. He said one of the most talented wrestlers on the planet, Malakai Black, a guy who beat him, gave him multiple losses. And then he talked about a man who needed no help that ended up getting help anyway. He's talked about not being being in the business of renaming people. Talked about Gunther. What was it he called him? Gunther?
Oh, Gunther McGillicuddy.
Yeah, I was going to say, McGillicuddy. He said Brody King as well has got balls to simply be around here and call himself Brody. And he talks about Brody and Darby and Miro and Sammy Guevara. These are men, he said, a lineage, a legacy of champions.
Jesus Christ.
Honestly, talking about. I'm reading this thinking, have I, like, combined then. I was like, no, this is what he said. He just kept going. A legacy of champions. He taught us. He talked about the TNT Championship, basically.
He did it like in South Park. Sammy, you got to my TNT title anything. Wrap it up.
He said, look, some people talk about secondary titles, and the only reason this is a secondary title now is because there are two of them. He said, it's pretty clear what we have to do, and he looks up at the ladder again. He said, Tony Khan, send me a contract in the mail today. Not the contract that I wanted, but regardless, he said, beach break, two titles, one champion. What do you say?
Oh. What do I say? I've got any idea. Like, I put over Murray's take. Murray said this was a spot fest of a promo where there was like no real substance to it. A lot of great things happening in it that possibly weren't connected to one another very well. I'm going to try and one up that analogy. This is a Big Show promo because like he was heel at the start, then he turned face because his delivery and his fire is unbelievable. He turns heel again because people are kind of getting lost. He said, people told me not to cut this promo yet. I was like, yeah, because you're building the best feud ever with CM Punk. And then he's dropping that, abandoning that thread. Like, a handful when it was like the original incredible viral marketing campaign, and we were all sat like total dorks, total marks on this podcast going, you can have a feud with him, you can have a feud with him, can't wait for it to come. Hanford had a great one.
Mm.
Sorry to step on your toes.
No, sorry.
But like Cody Rhodes did that, which CM Punk wanted to do. What a wonderful way for dickhead Cody Rhodes heel to rub that in his face and say, well, you should be chanting for me. Like, I'm the guy you always wanted to be. I'm the guy you should be wrestling with. That would have been great. And he builds that match, and he wastes it, the match isn't happening. It was still great. This is great, stupid. Like, what's going on?
I compared this to you.
This was genuinely great. Dot, 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 a point.
Yeah.
I said this was Triple H-esque, i.e. that Survivor Series when he booked three matches for himself at Mania.
That was the analogy I had. That was the promo equivalent of that specific match. Like, what is it? Jackie, the A code's 47 when you absolutely have to kill every motherfucker in the room. Just, John Moxley cut an all-time great wrestling promo at the start of the show. Cody cut an all-time great Cody one in the middle. This wasn't a great wrestling promo.
No one's ever Cody'd as much as Cody just Cody'd right there.
I promoted the wrong thing.
A vintage Cody Rhodes promo, this. Take that anywhere you want. Take it everywhere you want, because he certainly did. To try and analyse this with the like pros and cons of a normal wrestling promo is futile. I'll give it a bash. Everything he said, almost everything he said, was pretty powerful promo material. It was all the right fire. He was like hitting key points that got you excited for a match before he moved on to the next match. But all of them individually, like, you know, like sort of very sort of packaged little moments with these various hypothetical opponents were all pretty cool. I'll be cruel and just say it, like, he's the cleverest stupid wrestler in the game at the moment. Because not once did he attempt to thread any of this together. So he is just bouncing from line about a wrestler to line about a wrestler to line about a wrestler. In the kind of thing where, like, backstage, he probably thought, this is going to be awesome. This is my State of the Union address as a kayfabe, out-of-contract guy that is a bit of a loose cannon. And the whole theme is that, no, they told me not to say that, but I'm going to say it anyway. Like, this is like almost like a guy potentially that's demob happy, that's having his last night on the job and is kind of cutting a shoot promo on the very company. Like, he's having a go at the fans, but he's pretending that he's not. He's having a go at the company, but he's pretending that he's not, because that is this heel character now, a guy that's gradually starting to crack under the pressure of all of this. A lot of that is there, but that's for me to see. Cody didn't tell us any of that. Cody just went off on a bunch of different rants, like completely one detached from another. Like, what was I was thinking about this. So he might have been referencing Ricky Starks and Jay Lethal. Wish you picked somebody other than Jay Lethal. But Ricky Starks and Jay Lethal.
So I've got a job.
Yeah, as guys with indie pedigree, Ring of Honor pedigree, in contrast to Red Dragon. What did he say? Like, learning hip tosses at the performance center, or whatever it was. Like,
apologies, I tried to get as much as I could in that
promo. But, like, I have to join those dots, because he failed to do that. So if he's saying, like, one thing in contrast to the other, he's missed his mark completely, and it's just, right, I'm going to shoot on him now, I'm going to shoot on them now, do that sort of thing.
You're going to get put over. You're going to get put over. You know?
And he didn't, that was, the, you know, was the women's division. You know, you're going to get put over. Like the, aye, and then the, well, no, the, you know, was Sammy Guevara, let's be honest. Like, the one thing we didn't want to happen was him almost forgetting to promote the match that he was sent out there to promote. The only thing looming in the background was the giant ladder.
Oh, yeah, the ladder. Yeah, that's what I mean.
There is the reminder. Like, the four Hamlet followers will forgive me, but, like, the brass neck on Cody to take the piss out of NXT and then book a ladder match on the fly with no reason.
When there's going to be a Face of the Revolution ladder match, yeah, he's just at like, Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
I got one of them. Like, that wasn't the week to take a dig at NXT, was it? Like, this is what I mean. Just carnage, chaos, devastation left in this promo's wake. But, like, at this point, right, time to maybe... Like, the Codyverse is a thing now, isn't it? But, like, time to get off the idea that, like he's painting the biggest and most incredible picture of all. And time to just enjoy the fact that he just hot his paint at the wall. And it like, it looks pretty cool.
It's after Jackson
the
Pollock, right?
It's a Jackson Pollock from a car boot sale. Like, yeah, it's pretty cool to look at because there's a lot of very bright colours, but it's maybe time to, like, give up on the idea that there's focus, because clearly focus has been the biggest issue in Cody's life for the last year and a half. But, like, the peak of this current era of Cody was this promo. I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
When he was on that ladder at the end and saying, yep, we're going to do Shawn and Razor, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I want to see Cody and Punk. That's a misfire. That is a misfire. As compelling as this was and as great as the delivery was, when he started putting CM Punk's goddamn name in his mouth and basically saying, I'm more CM Punk than he is, I'm thinking, do that match.
He mentioned his, like, the Young Bucks as his friends, and I got like Elite vibes again. Like, remember that Cody was in the Elite once, and they could one day revisit that, and how cool it's going to be, you know? Like, yeah, the things that he was selling weren't what he was sent out there to sell. Maybe the contract stuff is a shoot, and like Tony Khan's thinking, do I want him? Maybe that's why he's not sending it yet. I think I'll just see where this goes.
Something good did come next, though. We got a backstage promo with TBS Women's Champion Jade Cargill and Anna Jay. And it's being set up. It's announced that match is coming next. Anna Jay's accepted the open challenge that Jade Cargill's put out there. And Smart Mark Sterling says, you haven't got what it takes. But thanks for accepting the challenge, basically. And John Silver's there. I was worried for a split second that the two men were going to do the talking for the women.
Quite honest.
John Silver talks about Anna's 24-inch arms, says she's hungry. And Anna Jay then says, look, Jay, do you need to realize there's a dark side to me? I wrapped barbed wire around my arm just to win a match. I will do whatever it takes to win. Will you? And Jade simply says, you need to understand who I am and where we are. And she points to the TBS title and says, that bitch show.
Yes, I covered this in the intro and this podcast goes long enough. Hamlet?
I loved it, man. Yeah. For all the reasons Cedric outlined at the start, I loved it. I love that, for me, the end game with Jade Cargill's title reign is a babyface turn that happens halfway through. She becomes just irresistible as somebody so popular for, like, Goldberging through all of these people. Like, Anna Jay now is obviously a babyface, and Jade Cargill will work a heel, but she will dominate her and she will destroy her, and fans back winners. So the more Jade wins or continues to win, the more that fans will back her. She'll ditch Smart Mark Sterling when the time's right. And then, I mean, I'm thinking Serena D, but there's plenty of others. The heel that solves the Jade Cargill puzzle will fit perfectly because Jade will have just turned babyface organically. She will become too cool not to cheer all the time. And this promo felt like the start of it, quite honestly. Like, she was... she didn't back down, she didn't show cowardice, she showed arrogance, but it's arrogance that's earned and informed by the fact that she's been awesome. Anna Jay is hungry, and that's absolutely fine. I'd just rather not see John Silver be so thirsty.
Have you been listening to the Predicting the Next AEW Champions podcast? Because I literally picked Serena Deeb.
Did you go deep? I think
spoilers, everyone, but go and check it out. Me, Andy and Sidge pitching all the next champions
there. When they babyface Jade Cargill, I think they can get there.
Then we got the Varsity Blondes versus the Kings of the Black Throne, who are
awesome.
Are awesome now, really.
It was awesome, man.
Griff Garrison and Brody King start us off. Brody King and Malakai Black work so well together. Quick tags to dominate. When Pillman gets the tag, he goes to do the springboard and just... He's not sure about it now.
He's ripping off AJ Styles and Chikara, isn't he?
After what happened previously, he hesitates. Brody King just stands there.
I'm surprised he knows how to put on YouTube.
So there's a bit on the outside with an argument between Pillman and Garrison. And in the midst of all
that real. There was a Sean and Marty energy. That wasn't the Griff's facials have never been so fucking convincing.
So Brody comes out and just trucks Garrison right into those steel steps. Pillman gets in the ring, starts fighting Malachi Black. He goes for a drop kick to the outside. Brody catches him, shoots him into the ring, and they double team Pillman, kicks sent on, and then they do that wonderful spot where Malachi Black just chucks their opponent, Pillman in this case, into Brody King. He catches him, hits the Dante's Inferno, as I was informed, for the victory. Post-match, Malachi Black gets on the mic and asks the members of the House of Black to please rise. And they're interrupted by Pac on screen, his on-screen promo. He's gone spooky bollocks now, and I don't care. he talks about having a new vision, a purpose. He says, I may be blind, but I truly see you, Malachi Black. You're the same as every other cretin in AEW. Like that line. Self-obsessed and power-hungry, it's exhausting. He said, he may have a few spells up his sleeves, but the bastard is beyond even your reach, Malachi Black. He is incorruptible. This is the moment I'm expected to bow down and call you master, he says. But
master,
I will make a martyr out of Black.
Yeah. I don't hate this Pac stuff as much as some people seem to do. It's removed from the camera effects and the suggestion of magic. Like a guy got mist in his eyes, got an eye injury, and now he's recovered. That's all it is. He's ready to fight now. That's all it is. It's just a bit of a pretentious way of doing it. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Kings of the Black Throne, because the class. The best thing about a squash match, there's two awesome things about a perfect squash match. I don't think this was perfect, but it was certainly incredibly effective. One, gratuitous, cruel, funny violence.
Griff Garrison ate platefuls of shit in this. Yes, my God.
That's awesome. That was class. So that's the one key ingredient. So just a two-course dish. Fish and chips. The other, chips, is you need to look buggered, right? You look like you cannot do anything against this tag team who's killing you within minutes, or Sid, or Gould, but you cannot do a goddamn thing. You cannot catapult back off the ropes, speared in half. You cannot run away. You can't defend yourself. You're dead. Mm-hmm. Between Malachi Black's incredible like MMA influence, like leg sweeps and like Brody King just squashing you with a senton, they look like couldn't do anything. Absolutely fucked. Yeah, they look like knackered. These two guys have got ring styles that complement one another superbly. Aleister Black, low-key, great tag team wrestler. We saw that in NXT and fleetingly on the main roster. The presentation's great. The theme, God's Hate, rips. Like, it's all fantastic, this.
Yeah, this...
Give
him the belt. Instantly rules. This... Like, some of this isn't a shock, is it? Some of it isn't a hot take. Like, Malachi Black hits people really hard and gets over, and then is given a little bit too much poetic license, and then needs to be dragged back into something that he... Like, somebody should tell him how good he is at this. And then I think maybe just focus predominantly on that. This tag team, like, just instantly feels like one of the hottest things to come along in AEW in ages. Timing is a bit of a shame with us knowing now how AEW books the Jurassic Express have got to go through the ranks a little bit. If the Lucha Brothers were still champions, I'd have booked that shock win like next week, the week after. Mm. I'd have just like raced to get the titles on these two, as it is they're going to have to
win. It is a shame. We're being, like, they built Jurassic Express so well last year.
Yeah.
Let's give them some, we're not being dicks to Jurassic Express.
No.
Built them very well, they're very over, but we're just in love with this act.
That's how wrestling works sometimes, isn't it? And like, here they are at this point. I'm somewhere in the middle of both here, I think. I don't think it's ever going to work with Pac. I've not sold my stock in him. I've sold my stock in it ever working in AEW. There's always too much stop and start and off and on. He's never felt like he's quite fitted in any of the stories, except maybe when they were getting the Brutalizer over with Kenny Omega way back when in like 2019. This one is the same. I'm still getting the vibes that this isn't quite right.
It's too hard to book. It's a booking headache, right? You're going to be here this week, right? You're going to be away for this long, right? We can't chin you all the time and write you off, so we kind of just have to vanish you very quietly sometimes. It's
kind of put belts on him.
Yeah. Goddamn shame. Just move.
Yeah.
We got a Lance Archer video. He's got Dan Lambert and Jake Roberts.
We live
now.
Here. It's not that good.
Jake Roberts speaks on Lance Archer's behalf. He's saying he won't wait in line anymore. He'd been offered a world title match, and it's now time for Hangman Page to bite the dust. We'll talk more about that when we get to the post-match here. And then we got a promo from Trent and Rocky Romero, I think it was. Yes. They sort of just interrupt Brandon Cutler, who's, I don't know, setting a camera up or whatever. And Trent, starting, isn't it? Because he's apologising for Rocky Romero being a bit of a dick to the dick that is Brandon Cutler. They talked about their history with the Young Bucks and the IWGP tag titles and et cetera, et cetera. And, yeah, they offer out a rematch. How about we run that one back? And, yeah, this just the bit of conflict between Trent and Romero surrounding being nasty to Brandon Cutler, basically. But and we'll talk about this obviously on the Rampage preview tomorrow. What a match that's going to be.
Yes, that's just it for the preview.
See, but like the Brandon Cutler stuff's really, really nice. There's a lot about nice little things happening in this.
And then we got Lance Archer versus Frankie Kazarian. I'm not sure whether this was booked to replace the FTR Lee Johnson and Brock Anderson match, one of them. The reason why that didn't happen, by the way, is one of them. Medical protocols, I think, is the correct terminology.
The correct euphemism.
Start saying it. I don't care. Like,
there should be more transparent with it. It's very WWE. I mean, then again, people might.
It's not even that anymore. Roman's got COVID. You know, like they're just. It's not.
People in question might not want it to be revealed.
I guess
so. Yeah. There is that to consider, but it's happened twice now. Be transparent about it. It's just such an easy win against the dicks who hopefully will be conquered. So I don't have to talk about it anymore.
But yeah, we got this match. It was announced at the start of the show that we were getting this match. This was a long old match that didn't really do a lot for me, and we've got to save time. We've already talked a lot on this show, so I'll give you the cliff notes effectively. Archer attacking Kazarian before the bell, beating him down throughout the commercial break. He did so for the next sort of 8 minutes, basically, until Kazarian countered a blackout, hit a missile dropkick, but then Archer fights back. Choke slam, black hole slam. He hits the blackout, and he gets the victory. Post-match, Tony Schiavone gets in there asking about the relationship between not just Lance Archer and Jake Roberts, but obviously Dan Lambert. Now, Dan Lambert gets on the mic. He talks about the fact that Paige wasn't raised outside. He didn't drink water from the hose. He said he and his friends just stayed inside, played video games, drank sparkling water. It's the biggest heel turn ever if you drink sparkling water for me, by the way. And he said the Toy Story movie made him want to be a cowboy. And what was that? I don't want to get this wrong. What was the term he used?
Jerking off a heifer, which is milk right from the teat, obviously, and nothing more.
He said, basically, Paige isn't prepared for Lance Archer, and Lance Archer grabs them.
As soon as Dan Lambert said the word hand job, I just heart went in my mouth. Like, don't say something homophobic.
Archer gets the mic. He said he's had enough of this cowboy BS. He's going to show Paige what he's going to do, and he chucks Kazarian out onto the ramp. He takes a chair with him. He's going to chokeslam him onto it, basically, until Hangman Page's music hits. He makes the save. He slaps Archer across the face after they square up. They trade strikes. Archer goes for the chair on the ramp. Paige kicks him into the ring, goes to the buckshot. Archer counters it, and eventually Paige punches him over the top rope. That was the end of the segment. What did you make of the match and the post-match?
Jesus Christ, this goddamn match. It was the three-minute heel heat spot in a commercial break, and that was the match.
10 minutes of that, yeah.
There was a little tiny hope spot tacked on at the end of it, but people have lost all faith in Frankie Kazarian as a result of the terrible booking he was subjected to last year.
They were talking about it, and he's been on a big win streak, haven't they? And I was like, well, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, so. It's another one of them, isn't it? Look, this was fairly disastrous, if I'm honest, because Hangman Page, like, his stock should be so much higher. Look, he got a major reaction. I thought that Page Archer Brawl was just hot enough, but I wasn't up for it because of how dire the match was.
Yeah, you gave us a cliff notes on the match I wish AEW had. This was otherwise, like on paper, this is quite a resourceful solution to a problem arising with that tag match not being able to go ahead. You find a way to give Lance Archer an easy win and then get to the Hangman Page stuff. Why couldn't it have been a really easy win? Like, if Frankie Kazarian was worth protecting, you would have protected him more in the like Bullet Club Hunter, the Elite Hunter stuff, and you didn't. And what we got, like, vibes, man, it like really dragged down the show at this point, and it got back up really quickly. But it doesn't help Hangman Page. There is still, I think, It's in the back of everybody's minds because the Danielson matches were awesome. But I think there's still a bit of lingering doubt about Paige. Like, I don't know, maybe he's a regular weekly TV fixture champion. It doesn't feel quite yet that he's the company figurehead in the way that all the other champions did.
No.
Maybe it was always going to feel different. He's a different proposition to Omega, Jericho and Moxley. But I don't know, this felt extremely mid-card. There were a lot of stuff on the show that felt like it was more prominent in the discourse and discussion than this feud.
We've got Matt Sydal, Lee and Dante Martin there. Lee says he's going to watch Dante's back just like he's watched theirs, you know, brother until his brother comes back, basically. And they, again, as Sid alluded to earlier, then cut to Starks and Hobbs who go, because you've got a bloody baby brother complex, haven't you? How many brothers do you think you've got? Nobody's your mate.
Piss myself. I'm counting on the... Again, they're listening. Like, this is a kind of a ludicrous thing. All these people that want to put an arm around Dante Martin and they're just counting on their fingers like these dweebs that Team Taz just need to wreck. Great.
And they're going to find out he's all alone. You need to watch every angle because Team Taz built assassins.
Love the format. Won't talk about that anymore. Wesley or Rush?
Yeah, that's a big question. That's fair. I want to talk about what came next with you, though, Michael Hamflett, because we get an interview with Chris Statlander and Red Velvet, and up comes... Oh, hang on, wait a second. Where are my manners? In comes Layla Hirsch.
And God bless the United States.
She says, Chris Statlander is... I mean, I better stop doing that from what she just did in this segment. She accused Chris Statlander of not being focused enough for their match on Rampage and costing her money, effectively. Red Velvet tries to calm her down. Layla Hirsch just tells her to shut up, chins both of them, in fact, and puts an arm bar on until officials have to break her up. It's happening.
Interruptions are great when they're not cliches. This was a spontaneous combustion, not somebody waiting around a corner to like spring on somebody with an attack. It was earned. It's been built. Layla Hirsch is now going to be based on how like AEW books, Layla Hirsch and Chris Statlander are going to feud, and Layla Hirsch is going to be focused upon. And I think we've all wanted all of that, what I've just said, for quite a while. So a success story. This
looks like a badass, doesn't she?
She looks like a total badass. If you don't do interruptions, the few interruptions you do actually mean something and are allowed to feel hot. This did. I bemoaned the direction they were taken with Layla Hirsch, because I just think her story's great, and she, look at the size of her, she's a great baby face. Then she does this, and I'm thinking, you know more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
The Team Taz calls her back, aren't they, when you see an attack like this?
Serena Deeb versus Sky Blue next. Won't take long for me to recap this. She just dominated her, out-wrestled her, guillotined her over the ropes, hit a brutal Deeb Tox, goes after Blue. I mean, she's got the match won again. She rolls her over, goes after the knee, and gets the submission following a Serenity Lock that she doesn't really let go of for quite some time.
She's just so mean. So mean, so skilled, so ruthless. Just great. It was a great squash match, this.
Fantastic squash. Two things I want to isolate quickly because Deeb deserves it. The angle on the Deeb Tox. How you do a Styles Clash and frame it like a snap suplex without killing somebody, I don't know. Because Jesus Christ, what was that, like a 30-degree snap, like when she went down on it? Unbelievable. But like technique, just perfect technique to look as dangerous as possible. The Serenity Lock gets crueler and crueler and crueler the more defeated the opponent is, which is such an inspired way to finish when you're a heel. And look what happens when you book a wrestler with consistency. Did you hear the Deeb, 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 Deeb chants in the crowd? That's what happens when a wrestler doesn't disappear for a fucking month. Like, full credit them. This is not... Cedric's pointed this out before, and it's a great observation. Those Jade Cargill squashes are kind of an excuse sometimes. See, we give you a woman's match. It's 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It's 30 goddamn seconds. This is both. This is the woman's match, and it's 30 seconds to a minute for a purpose. Love this.
Dan Lambert's making earning his money tonight because he's then backstage with the Men of the Year, Scorpio Sky, Ethan Page, the tightest tits in the game. How's that working out for us so far? Yeah, not great. We've still got time. We've got time. Someone's way off yet. They say Moxley returns and everyone bloody scatters, but not Ethan Page. He said, don't let the fancy clothes fool you or the sunglasses. I am up to the task. You don't need to look around because whilst John's been gone, I've been out here dominating, running the show, basically getting wins. Don't take me lightly. And he says, Khan, if you want that marquee match on Friday, book Page versus Moxley. Perfect.
Perfect. He's got the brilliant face. He can go. He's in the perfect position on the card to Moxley to steamroll through. Just an inspired match graphically.
And he got a partner for Eddie Kingston to make the save from.
Yeah.
Eddie Kingston's injured.
Is he?
Yeah. It's not a big one. Like, I think it's a 3-week orbital bone deal. Enough to keep him off the GC dub show.
Imagine if he had the things, though. Like the masks they wear in football. He'd somehow make that look badass.
Yes, yeah, great, a great pairing.
I'll get to the main event. Okay, got Darby Allin and Sting and the Acclaimed, but first, Hardy Family Office and Andrade El Idolo. They announced that Matt Hardy has sold 51% of the HFO, but they are still going to hold the majority of the board seats. Hardy's going to be CEO, Andrade's going to be new president, and they are now going to be known as the AHFO, and Andrade wants to buy that little boy Darby Allin.
Is this f***ing shit on purpose? Boards of directors and seats at the table and that. Like, we all quite enjoy Andrade. The idea of Andrade buying Darby Allin ahead of them having an absolute ripper on a pay-per-view is great. And Andrade looks like he's having fun with it too. The rest of this was absolute toilet. And they're taking the piss out of us with the level of, like, they felt like they were taking the piss out of the Butcher and the Blade. So, like, at least they felt relatable. Just, what is this?
I've got no idea what it is. They've ruined the one good thing about Andrade that wasn't him bumping stupidly on his head.
God, diving into fire.
It's the only good thing he's been... It's all he's good for in AEW, is Andrade. He's just working CTE matches with Pac. And then he's finally got this like really cool storyline idea. You finally get a flash of like, oh, wait. And then Matt Hardy gets involved. And, whoa, God damn it. They've got the same job titles. Like, the job titles are effectively synonymous.
It's 51, that's 49. What I want from my wrestling business terminology.
Do you remember when, like, Edge and Christian took the piss out of all the multi-layered authority? They were like, we're still working for the faction.
Yes.
There was the faction, there was the regime, and they were like, really good Brian Gowitz sort of mocking the process a little bit. Like, Private Party or the Butcher and the Blade need to do that. Like, who's a boss here? Like, who are we working for?
What are we doing now?
Main event time, the Acclaimed versus Darby Allin and Sting. Brilliant video again from the Acclaimed, mocking the black and white Darby Allin videos. I want to give a nod as well to Max Caster's excellent rap. The Acclaimed, beating that ass if you're hating, fighting with us is gory self-mutilation. Lovely. And also a reference to making this night for Sting worse than Starrcade 97.
Class.
Did you catch Shivani? I don't know what was going on in Starrcade 97.
I got mixed emotions, I've got to be honest, about this match. Because they attack during Sting's entrance and they do the spot where they wrap a chair around Darby Allin's neck and send him into the ring post. He's taken away by the medics. And Sting opts to fight 2-on-1.
Can I put the medics over here? I thought they were fantastic. I thought they were goddamn fantastic. Just what they looked like. Jesus Christ, the situation is developing here. I thought they were great. Not histrionic, just really well done.
That's fair. So Sting, because he's a legend, decides to carry on and just fight the match 2-on-1. He holds his own, fights off both of them. But as he goes for a Stinger Splash, Bowens avoids it and rips off the turnbuckle pad. So Sting goes into the metal and eats a drop kick, 2 count off the back of that. And they beat him down effectively throughout the commercial. When we come back, Sting fights back, double clotheslines, puts on a scorpion deathlock on Caster. Bowens does the discus forearm, and Sting just looks at him, which was just sensational. Bowens finally does manage to break it up, and he also twats Sting with a boombox on the outside. They are looking to beat him down even further, and Steel Steps are going to get involved. And then here comes Darby Allin, who's apparently fine now, which, you know, popped the crowd. It pissed me off. I have to admit, I was not a fan of this. I thought it was absolutely preposterous. That if he's come back from having his neck crushed, effectively.
It's his throat.
No, I'm not having it. But regardless, I get it why people were...
Pilmanize him.
He didn't have to cut a promo at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Sting, I'm here. I'm here, Sting.
So he hits a diving tackle onto Max Caster. He gets the hot tag. And you know what? At that point, I was right back into it. Coffin drop on both the Acclaimed out on the floor. Hits a code red. That gets a near fall. Put Caster in a hanging guillotine. But Caster managed to make it to Bowens for the tag. And they fight back and hit the mic drop. Sting breaks up the pin attempt. He gets sent to the outside. Caster's sent out there as well. And his Sting is sort of recovering. And Caster is letting us say, we're going, bloody hell, this is a... taking it out of me a bit. Sting diving splashes onto Caster through the table and back in the ring. Darby Allin hits a stunner and the coffin drop for the victory for the Acclaimed.
I thought this was cracking. I thought it was expertly constructed in the way that there's a formula, but they subverted it and still make it work. There is a formula. Instinct does all the work. It's weird. And it's, yes. And it's fantastic, but like they did it in a different way this time. Genuinely had a massive smile on my face watching this, like getting Sting to do these crazy spots, but measuring them perfectly because he spent a lot of time just doing dark arts, craftsman stuff where like, he was roaring after being kicked, trying to break up the Scorpion Deathlock. With the kick, he's roared in their faces. Like, that requires no work whatsoever. Just brilliant facial expressions and of when to do certain things. So that preserves that body, that miraculous body, to do that incredible spot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is magic. I will, however, say that unless they're going to do something ridiculous, like Darby and Sting versus Jurassic Express at Revolution, I'm ready now to want to love Sting all over again. And the way to accomplish that is by not doing something like this for about a month and a half.
Yeah, I'm already there, in truth. I didn't have, like, I like this, but I didn't feel much for it, you know? Like, I like the action in front of me. I was watching live, and I was online at the time, and there was a few comments suggesting, oh, it's, like, surprisingly heatless in the building. I don't agree with that. I think AEW kind of reaped what they sowed here. This is actually a reminder of the booking failures of the last month or so. This wasn't a particular... Like, their videos were great. The private party... The acclaimed viral videos were tremendous. But the stuff, like, very, very basic. We're just fighting for fighting's sake, really. And I think that's what the wrestlers got in the building on the night. Like, you were being treated to some pretty entertaining spots and some nice Sting moments and all this. And the acclaimed are great and growing and improving. But this didn't feel like a big Sting match. This didn't have the atmosphere of one of these big, for me anyway, one of these big Sting and Darby tag matches. A nice television main event, a nice way for a good Dynamite to go off the air. But it didn't leave much. The big Sting spot, as big and as bombastic as it was, will be gone out of my head tomorrow compared to the Double or Nothing one against Men of the Year that like I still go back and rewatch quite regularly. Yeah. There's kind of like levels to the use of Sting. And I think Sidgwick's point, I think I must have passed at the last match. And it doesn't hurt, you know, to not split them up, but separate them a bit because Darby's effectively a tag wrestler at this point. And if you want to get him back on the single track, at some point you're going to have to build a bit of distance back between them.
And you know what? They're going to because he's working Andrade.
Going
to do it. So it's what I get. It's what I just let it play out.
Maybe that'll splinter off and you can just do Sting and Matt Hardy singles.
Let's know your thoughts on that and all of the things we've discussed today on Twitter at WhatCultureWWE. Watch, they can follow all three of us, of course. You can follow Michael Hamflett at
Michael Hamflett.
Follow Michael Sidgwick at
M Sidgwick.
Follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE. As I said, make sure you subscribe to WhatCulture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts. We will be back later on today to discuss potential Royal Rumble winners. Just over a week to go until that one. But for now, this has been the AEW Dynamite review. My thanks to the Dudley Boys. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.